we get it underway this afternoon in the second hour, as always, on Tuesday, by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His new book is out. I'm holding a copy in my hand. It is Scrooge. It is awesome. Hello there, Sea Dog.
Rich guy, Kimbo, and the Sea Dog kicking off another year. Couple buddies.
Absolutely. Are you, I have to know, are you drinking a cold hot chocolate?
No, I am drinking a cold bottle of water for my throat so I don't have a coughing fit as I talk to you. But I did suck down the remainder of a cold hot chocolate earlier this morning. It had been a, well, maybe I should say it was a congealed cold hot chocolate at that point. But I was able to, with the help of gravity, get it down my gullet.
Now, you attack the stairs, a little little sore throat, cough, whatever it is you're dealing with. That's not going to stop you. It's not going to slow you down.
That's the great thing about the stairs, because despite what people think, when the calendar flips, there is not a huge teeming crowd lining up to run those stairs. Lo and behold, I still have them all to myself. So when I projectile cough and mucus goes to flying, I'm really the only one affected by this.
But you were talking yesterday on the blog about one of the unforeseen challenges of running even in cold conditions, that it's not just in the summertime when the perspiration becomes an issue.
Now, someone had said to me this past summer, they're like, I can't believe you do that when it's so hot out. And that's the breathing thing and the humidity and all that. But there are other problems with which to contend in winter, because you have to go out in all kinds of layers, no matter like how tough you think you might be. So I have on a t-shirt, a sweatshirt, and then kind of like a windbreaker jacket over that. And because you're running and it doesn't take that long, you start to sweat through everything. So it becomes heavier. And you really notice that too, because it's like clinging to your body and it's all gross. But after like 2,000 stairs or whatever it is, you take a break. That has to be a pretty short little rest that you take there, because you start to freeze awfully quickly, and then it becomes harder than when you started to get warm back up again. So the most I've ever done in a day on those stairs is 20,000. But you're really pressed to come anywhere near that, because that requires so many breaks to do 20,000. So 3,000 today, 5,000 each of the days over the weekend. But I like it, Kimball, because stairs themselves, you'll never find two staircases that are exactly alike. It's a great life learning lesson. And stairs, you think you have them mastered, but each staircase is different in all the different seasons. I mean, it's really gets pretty deep out there alone by myself on those stairs.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's discuss this wonderful new book of yours, Scrooge. You were kind enough to send me a couple of weeks ago the PDF version of it so I could read it before my copy arrived. It came in the mail yesterday. I love it. Got a beautiful cover, and it's an absolutely terrific read. I love the movie it's all about the 1951 Alistair Sim film. For my money and for yours, the best of all the adaptations, but it's more than just that, and let's approach this on a couple of different levels. Let's begin with your personal connection to this film.
Sure, and I think it's good, too, that we're talking about this after Christmas, because it does this film, in my view, a disservice to even, although, of course, I had to do this, I had to show the context, but it's not a film that I ever even really think of in relation to other adaptations of A Christmas Carol, nor do I even really think of it as a Christmas film, and for many reasons, not a Christmas film, and certainly not limited to being a Christmas film, because I think the film is a lot better than that. I think it stands apart in its own category, which is itself a synthesis of all kinds of different categories, which we can touch on. But my own personal connection to the film was, what the book does is it weaves together various strands of, call it, meaning. And one of those strands of meaning for me, in addition to all the hardcore stuff you get about the soundtrack and the cinematography and the script and all of those other things that we can delve into, was an experiential component for me, because I was rather Dickensian in my origins myself. So people don't know the story from the blog or whatever. I was adopted, and I had two sisters, twins, who were my younger sisters, who were also adopted, came along a little bit after. And their biological mother rescinded them as such, I guess you could say. And they were taken from our family. And that really did a number on my mother, especially, I would say, and then on me for different reasons. I was always thinking that I was going to be snatched away. And it's funny, in a horrible way, the way certain things played out in my life later on, that idea of just having something ripped from you was going to become a theme of my life. So I was on guard sort of at night because I figured that might be when the snatching was going down. I had to go see like a therapist and all this kind of stuff. And I went wandering in the house and someone must have left the TV on. I don't think it magically went on, but maybe it did, in the family room. And I entered during my midnight creep as Michael Horden, as the ghost of Jacob Marley, was about to play his visit upon Scrooge, Alistair Sim. And I was scared of the dark, and I like monster movies and all that stuff. The way I treat this film is a kind of horror film for our age. And I wasn't scared, though. I sat down to one of the greatest bravura moments in all of horror cinema. And I watched this by myself in the middle of the night. And then later, many years later, it came to me again when I was an adult and I had an even worse time I was going through. So there's that personal connection for me that is part of my filmic experience with this picture.
And again, you write this book looking through the lens of horror films, more so than a Christmas film or a holiday film. And can you talk about the elements of horror that are ever present in this 1951 movie?
It borrows heavily, and I would say transcends, movements like German Expressionism. We know that famous scene from Nosferatu, of the vampire on the staircase, speaking of stairs, going up and doing its thing, and it's all shadow and tendril. And we think about the shadowlands of Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. That's very much how this film looks. When Scrooge comes to his house, which in this treatment is the house that Jacob Marley died in. So he's taken everything from Marley. He probably even like sleeps in his bed with the same old sheets. And to the bed is where Scrooge goes, because he can't handle life. He's depressed. And that's really how it ties in to how we are in many ways now. So if you just were to look at the film, if you hit the mute button, take the sound out of it, you're going to see what looks to be a haunted house. You're not going to see the trappings of Christmas. There are no wreaths here. There's no mistletoe. There's very little of the holiday joy that we expect with any Christmas picture. And if you just came in at any point during this movie, you wouldn't think you were watching a Christmas film. It came out for good reason on Halloween 1951, and it didn't play during the polite hours on American television for many, many, many decades. The version that was favored was the 1938 Reginald Owen version, and Owen was this grandfather type and with an avuncular vibe, and it was like, I remember seeing once this photo of some hockey player from like the 1920s, I don't remember who it was, but he was kind of like crammed into this jersey, and someone made a joke as a caption saying, it looks like your uncle, after like having the Thanksgiving dinner going out in the pond for some shinny, like he's still up for it. That's kind of the Scrooge that we got with Reginald Owen, but that's not the Scrooge that we get with Alistair Sim. The Scrooge we get with Sim is a man who cannot handle his world, and he self-medicates, and he sleeps too much, and he can't deal. He's depressed. It's really a film in many ways about depression and havens and safe spaces and not being able to cope with reality. And so I would say it's a film that's more relevant than at any other time when it was during its sort of like glory days. It wasn't even seen. It was something you only caught as this midnight movie of post-Christmas death.
You write in the book, Colin, about how this film highlights the power of a ghost in an incongruous setting.
Well, I think we have to remember that it's a ghost story, and it doesn't have a lot of the joviality, the impishness of the Dickens novella. Now, the man who writes the screenplay for this film, and he adds a lot, and you have to remember how ballsy that was, because Dickens was the guy who invented Christmas, as we say, and this fellow, Noel Langley, was his name. He introduces this entire backstory where we see the quote-unquote friendship between Marley and Scrooge. I guess we could call it a frenemy-ship, really, because they weren't exactly thick as thieves. And they're together in their relationship because they're both so scared of the world. It has very much an internet social media vibe to it. Like, I'll hit the like button for you if you hook me up, and there's no real connection. But it's very much a story of these ghosts. But they're not played for laughs, especially the initial appearance of the ghost version of Marley. You have something like the creation scene is what I liken it to in Frankenstein, where it's just one of those tour de force, virtuosic horror moments. We can think of the editing from that James Whale 1931 film, and Boris Karloff is the monster, and the fingers start to move. Like, you can see this all in your head right now, even if you've not sat through the picture. And then Colin Clive declaring, it's alive, now I know what it feels like to be God," and the accompanying thunder crash. When Marley comes in, he is the scariest ghost I've ever seen in my life, of being deeply steeped in horror. So you have that sort of real ghost, but then you have this other idea of the ghost that we're all haunted by as we move about. We have the ghost of technology. We have the ghost of self-doubt. We have the ghost of memory. We have the ghost of whatever leads us to the self-medication. We have the ghost of not being able to get out of bed. We have all of those kind of living ghosts of incongruity. And I think we see that abundantly with Scrooge in this film as he walks around before the ghost, the official ghost, put in their visit to him.
And we'll talk more about Alistair Sim in a little bit, but let's go back to Jacob Marley and the incredible performance. The movie wouldn't be what it is without the work of Michael Horner.
He's a big favorite of mine, and I've teased this. We've talked about him reading the ghost stories of M.R. James, and that's in the book too. I mean, I think one of the things about the book is that you get a thorough class in horror cinema, in literature, in painting, in the mores of the 21st century world that supersedes, I hope, and I believe, taking a film class or a symposium on Victorian ghostly literature. And so you really have to get into the performances of these actors. Michael Horner was one of those character actors that was around for a long time. He's Gandalf. People might know him in the 1981 adaptation from the BBC of Lord of the Rings. And so he had a long career, and he is... He's the master of the bleep-eating grin when we see him in business, as we're told, with Scrooge. But when he enters that room, you have to watch the byplay between these two. Scrooge is scared out of his mind. And it's a wonder to me. I just knew so much fear, I guess, that as a child I was not more terrified by this. Because I can see the frisson of the horror when I watch this scene. When Scrooge does his whole thing, he's like, no, I don't believe you. Cool. And the way that Horden's Marley handles not being believed is something you need to see to believe. Because you could just sort of like cross-cut it with every other version there's ever been. From 1938 to 1984 to the 1970 Albert Finney to the production that you go see at the high school or whatever it is. It is terrifying. It is visceral, and as I watch it, I've seen this film hundreds of times, I always laugh that they were trying to put this forward ostensibly, but also not really, like, Merry Christmas, here's a Christmas film. And it's just not.
You know, one of the things I love about this version, and you talk about it a great deal in the book, and I've had the chance as an actor to be in a million versions of A Christmas Carol. I think I've played everybody but Scrooge somewhere along the way, but quite often with theater, because you're also aiming to reach a younger audience, it's done with a wink and a nod. And as you point out of the book, even Dickens did a lot of that. There's not much of that in this film.
No, not at all. What there is comes largely from Alistair Sim. He is witty, but he is witty as he's being a dick and abusive, and even physically abusive. He shoves children. He literally shoves children out of the way in this blackened alley that has more darkness than you get in a film noir, like Out of the Past, which is famous for its darkness. It's a kitchen sink realism film. It's film noir. It's German expressionism. It's fantasy. It's family drama, especially with Noel Langley changing the birth ages of Scrooge and his sister. I would say that A Christmas Carol is close to a perfect work of art. But this, now it gets a leg up. It had that boost from having that source material. But if you just look at, like, example A and example B, I think this is even the stronger work of art. So you're not getting those moments, though, where Dickens's funny third-person narrator says, oh, and I'm in the space between, like, the crook of your elbow. And you kind of, like, look down at your elbow. It's like, oh, no, are you in there? Like, right? But you're not doing, oh, no, are you in there with this? You're immersed and you're thinking, God damn, I am in there.
Early in the book, you talk about Alistair Sim, his background, his physical appearance, his teeth, which make him so unique. But you devote an entire chapter to the eyes of Alistair Sim, which are, I think, the key to this portrayal.
The teeth don't hurt. I think I called them something like ablated fence slats. But the eyes are going to be one of his prime methodologies of acting. They communicate worlds. You can see, he probably has the most expressive eyes of any actor I can think of. And the eyes of Sim had a certain shape. They're bulbous in a way, but they're not kind of insecty. They work with the uniqueness of his face, but in those eyes are so many reflections in this film. You can just read his eyes, like a quarterback reads the defensive back. You can read his eyes, the fear in them, when he's dealing with the ghost version of Jacob Marley. And this isn't just going to be something that abrades your soul, because this is one of the darkest pictures, certainly the darkest Christmas picture, if we're even going to call it a Christmas picture, which again I think is just erroneous, and we almost shouldn't. It has moments, too, of the converse. We've talked about the Pogues and the notion of the sacred and the profane and how they ride together. And someone like F. Scott Fitzgerald would even make a conscious choice to use two words that had contrasting sounds. He's like, that's one of the techniques I use. So much as we have the horror, and the horror isn't just, oh, look, here's Jacob Marley's ghost. The first ghost takes Scrooge on a tour of his most humiliating, debasing, painful moments, many of which he was the author. He's being shamed in the most naked sense. And he can't, I would say the emotional terror of this film is what really makes it the most horrifying. And there are certain moments in it, and I really focus on them, like when he watches his the love of his life leave his life. He watches his, not just his sister die, but he watches himself be a horrible man as she's in the process of expiring. He begs. He's supplicant to the ghost. He says, please, I don't want to see this anymore. I can't take it. How many of us are like that now? And you see it all in his eyes. But at the same time, at the end, you have the moment, I would say, of the greatest joy in all of cinema. Mm. People have seen this film, They know exactly the moment I'm talking about. It's really centered on in the book near the end. And again, it's through the reflection of those eyes that we experience that.
And the movement of Alistair Sim is so crucial as well. You talk about the way he darts from place to place in the story.
He's one of those people who, if he was an athlete, we would say he's quick but not fast. So he would be like Dustin Pedroia, getting to a lot of balls at second base in his prime. And his eyes dart, too. There's this idea of movement contained within the Scrooge character in Sim's performance, of untapped movement, movement that just can't get out, because this is someone who's not living a life. When Cratchit says his thing near the beginning, I'll be making merry, can I have the day off? There is a look of contempt that Sim, as Scrooge, gives him. And talk about talking down your nose at someone. He essentially ranks on him for being so poor. I mean, it's one of the most... We've talked about, remember, John Lennon, and how uncomfortable it was to read about how Cynthia Lennon came home and found Lennon with Yoko Ono, and Lennon himself wasn't even contrite about it. He just sort of carried on and like made himself some cereal. It's just, it's horrible. It's something to change your mind about how you think about someone. When Scrooge, and there's just a few syllables, when he says that to Cratchit, you're just shattered. Like, I'll retire to Bedlam. It's vicious. There's nothing like that. I defy anyone to find some seasonal offering where you'll encounter, I guess you could be like, well, Black Christmas, when the guy calls up and says not nice things to the sorority girls. Okay, fine. But that's meant to be over the top. This is humanness. This is real. We all have moments like that where we're withering, and we're withering with ourselves, and it costs us a portion of our humanity. And again, that's why I think this is more relevant than ever, because Scrooge isn't the miser. Scrooge is us. He's 2022, us. So the resonance is just sublime to me.
We're talking with Colin Fleming about his book, Scrooge. Another thing that makes the film so powerful is the music and the work done by composer Richard Adensel. And you write about the way he interweaved the melody of the old Scottish tune, Barbara Allen.
He does a number of interesting things, and since this is one of the advantages to being someone who also writes about music, Kimball, he takes Christmas carols and he cracks them open, and in the middle of these carols, he puts dissonances and utilizes atonality. I mean, we're really going for it here. This is modernist music via Christmas carols that you think you know. So it's like Christmas carols by way of 1965 John Coltrane. And I talk about that. And so he also plays upon our heartstrings, and not in a lacrimose way, by using the Scottish ballad Barbara Allen. And again, it's funny because you have this film that's just really terrifying in so many different ways. As a ghost story, as a doomed story of a doomed man, as an indictment of us all, as a mirror that is held up to all of us, especially now in our world. But you also have this beauty and this kindness and this hope in this film. You have the admixture of life, Kimball, and partially why we have that is because of the way he uses Barbara Allen. Now, he uses it at first, and for quite a while, as a threnody, as a song of the dead. And from the dead, though, we're going to get Christ style, but with a man, a secular man, a resurrection of sorts. And so when the final time, when we hear, after everything we've been put through with Barbara Allen, in different keys, at different tempos, when we have the final visitation of Barbara Allen, I don't know how you watch that film and not cry. It's just one of the most touching moments in all of moviedom.
The director of the film, Irish director Brian Desmond Hurst, directed over 30 films in his career, but is there any doubt in your mind that this was the high water mark of everything he did?
No doubt. And it's weird. In some ways, it's a really weird I tweeted something about an album from 1958 tonight called Something Else by Cannonball Adderley. And Cannonball Adderley was buddies with Miles Davis. Miles Davis comes in, and it's just one of those great one-offs in jazz history. It's one of the best albums in jazz history, but it's not a band that, like, ever reprised. It's like, here's the second one, here's the third one. They were just kind of there that day. This is the kind of there, not that day, but for a spell, where you have these talents. You have Noel Langley, the writer of Wizard of Oz. You have Alistair Sim. You have Michael Horton. You have Adam Self. And you have director Brian Desmond Hurst, who is marshaling all of this together. And he was a fine director. There's nothing wrong with him. And he was good at handling Irish-related literature. And John Ford liked him and asked his advice. But he didn't make masterpieces. He made one. This just is how everything came together for him. And I've always been struck by what is so clearly his vision, because this went against the grain of everything that was ever done with cinematic adaptations of Christmas Carol. Another thing, too, there were no horror films at the time, being like from the 1940s and really like through the 50s until the Hammer era in Britain. So you had to do, if you're going to do horror, you had to sort of backload it into, like David Lean would do that with his Dickens adaptations. But they weren't like horror horror. This is horror horror. He's having Adam Self do what he's doing with the music. He's treating it as all this mashup of all these different genres at once. He's flying in German expressionism. He's tapping American film noir. I don't know what got into the guy's head. And doing this book, I didn't come any closer to learning. I think really just what happens sometimes with people who have talent, and once can be enough, as Orson Welles said, they just bloody go for it. And this was the moment in his artistic life when he said, screw it, I'm just bloody going for it.
Colin Fleming's new book is Scrooge, and it's a look at the film, a film that I've loved for years and years, and I appreciate it even more after reading Colin's book. You'll have a better understanding of The Sea Dog as well, and you get a great course in film history and history of the arts too. Pick up Scrooge. It's available right now on Amazon.com. Of course, as always, subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Go to Colin's website at ColinFlemingLit.com. Colin, thank you as always, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
Yeah, it sounds good, sir.